Hello everyone, this is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. I would remind you that last week I was hoping to read out Archangel Michael's message, but I didn't quite get time, and I didn't want to split the message up, because I think something of that nature needs to be read straight through. I've got a couple of old UFO reports. I'm coming to the conclusion that the older ones sometimes are more interesting. For some reason, they do seem to be more detailed and often of an unusual content. I've got quite a few general news items. So I'll start, as usual, with Sheldon Nidal's weekly report on behalf of the Spiritual Hierarchy and the Galactic Federation. It reads this week that the final struggle between the last dark cabal and our Earth ally stalwarts grinds on. It has reached a definitive point in which the conflict has been reduced to a legal and procedural duel. The Dark Cabal is using its remaining positions of power as leverage points in an effort to forestall the inevitable. Countless last-minute decrees and a whole slew of procedural contingencies have kept our Earth allies' goals just out of reach. This includes ongoing contrivances, which keep you from receiving your promised deliveries. But these things are almost over. A diverse team of specialized and distinguished lawyers and jurists are currently disposing of the last legal hold-ups. Concurrently, those working to remove the present rogue U.S. regime are implementing a secret operation long in the planning. The Dark's objective to engulf your global society in chaos has arrived at a point which threatens your world's long-term survival. This realization has mobilized many nation-states, which until now sat on the sidelines, to enter the fray on our side. This further seals the fate of the Dark Cabal and creates an unprecedented watershed in your history. Your power elite are polarized into two camps. One side intends to maintain the status quo, or in the event of defeat, to lay waste to the planet by way of revenge. The other, to bring in a new power-sharing agreement whereby the people of the planet are fully included in that process. These two positions have hardened over the last 6 months. As the member nations moving to oppose the Dark escalates, the disarray within the Dark Cabal soars. Its members are scrambling to somehow turn around what has become a fast-rising groundswell of discontent of global proportions. We maintain our role, as Heaven suggests, as monitors and intelligence analysts and advisors to the light. Keeping all parties fully informed is paramount, as your world swiftly morphs into a living preamble for first contact. This coming period in your history will be characterized by a general distancing from the power structure that has kept your world embroiled in contrived divisions, hatreds, and strife. Harmony, understanding, and a vast financial abundance will rise up to take their place. Already, a growing momentum to institutionalize global peace is beginning to affect the way the world works. Encouraged by this, those who champion beneficial change are forging ahead with governmental and fiscal mechanisms, which have the potential for becoming unified bedrock for your nascent global society. As we survey these trends, we try to spot those developments that might grow into features of your unique galactic society. For example, the new fiscal system with its debt annulment and global prosperity sets the stage for muscular, environmental and political concords. In fact, your rising levels of consciousness are to awaken within you a passion for rehabilitating Mother Earth and her destitute humanity, which paves the way for an open arrival on your beautiful shores. First contact draws closer with each passing day. These latest glitches are only temporary And what you are witnessing are the dead twitches of the dark. The forces of light now have the wind at their backs, and this is whipping up the dark ones' worst fears. Falling on full-blown panic, they issue decrees intended to staunch the tide of rebellion. But all this does is to inflate the chaos, which severely distorts the public's perception of what is truly happening. At every turn, the denizens of the shadows confront the rays of a new dawn, telling them that their time is up. And yet they still writhe and plot and are unable to accept what stares them in the face. Above all, they reel at the prospect of first contact. At a stroke, our arrival shatters the mental-emotional control grid that they have constructed to keep you in ignorance and bondage, and open windows to reveal not only a wholly new creation, but also the truth about who and what you are. The initial purpose of Heaven's mission to restore you to full consciousness is to introduce you to the wonders of this multidimensional universe. We never tire of gazing in awe at the beauty of this magnificent experiment of the Divine Creator. To watch stars, planets and galaxies being created is awe-inspiring. The huge palette of colors and hues, many of them beyond your ken, is breathtaking. Of most absorbing interest is to discover the infinite forms, shapes and sizes that life takes on. And one of our great joys is exploring this endlessly enthralling panorama. These things we speak of cannot begin to be put into words, and can only truly start to reveal themselves once full consciousness is regained. The work of the Creator is something we long to share with you, and once you have been restored to your true selves, you and the Creator are to combine to produce something exquisite. The present phase of first contact is to ensure that the coming events swiftly materialize. Thereupon, the shackles and cover-ups of the past will be dismantled, unmasking a plethora of truths, which will lead naturally to the announcements that will pave the way for first contact. The implications of this event far outstrip anything that has happened in 5 millennia of your recorded history. At last, we can come to you, not in deep cover, as prophets and messengers, but as open representatives of your space family. The sacred orders of your ascended masters, likewise, will come as ambassadors of your spiritual families. Together we come to complete your metamorphosis into fully conscious beings of light. This is the being that is to be found, your new and unique galactic society. Deep within each of you, you can feel just how close the impending changes are. However, an effective first contact requires a certain preparedness, and in this, it must be pointed out that your beliefs and level of technology have been artificially held back and are a bit behind what they should be for a normal first contact. The important point here is the divine purpose that lies behind these proceedings. We have been detailed by Heaven to assist in a singular task, namely, to prepare for first contact a world benumbed and traumatized by a millennia of brainwashing by the dark. In the teeth of dogged obstruction by your last cabal, we first evaluated how to intercede in your global affairs. Then we drew up plans to complete a full-fledged contact scenario covering all contingencies. The last step now underway is the actual carrying out of the mass first contact. This phase is progressing well, and we expect our Earth allies to complete their last task as planned, thus allowing us to complete our part of the schedule on time. The timetable requires of us 3 distinct roles. First, as covert advisors to our Earth allies, thus also ensuring ourselves that you are ready for our formal appearance. Second, as active players who come forward and after a series of formal announcements, execute the mass landing scenario. Finally, we are to assist you in your long overdue obligations to redress the damage done to Mother Earth. We also need to explain what full consciousness and galactic society are, and to run you through a number of preliminaries that will show you what comes next. You are partially to experience some aspects of the next step in your consciousness development. Then we will show you the places where your final metamorphosis can take place and where the miracle that is you can be manifested in its fullest divine measure. Message closes saying, today we continued with our discussion of what is happening on your world. We reviewed what our tasks are and how we intend to carry them out. You are on the verge of a divine miracle that is to return you to full consciousness and permit you to actualize those lifetime goals chosen by heaven and you before birth. And so ends Sheldon's message. It once again very uplifting. And one senses, I think, how near this time of first contact is approaching. On the basis of my own messages, the majority of which come through the ETs, also connected with the Galactic Federation, I would say that we might see some positive openings from about July onwards. The earlier the better, of course. Now I come to my general news items, and I'm guessing that the top news, if you've read about it or heard about it, must be not just the one attempt on Cheney's life, but also two. Now, one came up through the email via someone called, Saoirse Fowle. Now, what I haven't been able to determine is what she actually represents, whether she is a journalist for a magazine, a paper, or what. It doesn't actually say on the email copy I have here, but it talks of a report. I beg your pardon, I'll just have a sip of water, getting a bit dry. Right, I'm back with you then. That's a bit better. Now, Saoirse Fowle sent out this report as one which she reported to her Western subscribers, and there's a note on here saying visit author's website. So maybe the answer is in that she actually writes some private books. Anyway, what we have here is a report dated the 25th of February, and it talks of Russian FSB sources who were reporting on that day that an attempt had been made by special forces troops of the United States military to arrest the American Vice President Cheney shortly after boarding his official plane in Australia. And apparently that resulted in at least three dead and an unknown number of wounded. But I have to say, yeah, I said both reports I've got were attempts on his life. But I beg your pardon, this one actually refers to his arrest. The report goes on to say that these reports state that the United States Air Force, which is in control of the American Vice President's plane, sent an urgent flash message shortly after takeoff from Sydney, Australia, alerting their US Pacific Command forces through the United States Worldwide Military Command and Control System network, and which is monitored by Russian military forces, of the deaths aboard the plane and requesting orders. At the sealed-off Sydney airport, where the attempt by US military forces to arrest the American Vice President occurred, the Australian media is reporting as follows. Quote, Mr. Cheney's Boeing 757 was delayed temporarily at Sydney airport this morning for an unknown reason, as it stood still revving its engines to make its initial advance towards the runway. It suddenly powered down, the main door opened, and the mobile stairwell then immediately returned to the plane, but it was waved off by security personnel. The plane then proceeded to the runway and took off en route to the United States. Apparently, the US media reports were stating that there was a generator problem on the Vice President's plane and that it was making a planned fuel stop in Singapore, but which the American White House is denying was diverted. It appears that the concern of the American military generals regarding their vice president stems from his plans to attack Iran, and which in an unprecedented move, many of these top United States generals have threatened a mass resignation. And they say that, as we can read, as reported by Britain's Sunday Times News Service in their article titled, US generals will quit if Bush orders Iran attack. Now that article says the following, that some of America's most senior military commanders are prepared to resign if the White House orders a military strike against Iran, according to highly placed defense and intelligence sources. Tension in the Gulf region has raised fears that an attack on Iran is becoming increasingly likely before George Bush leaves office. The Sunday Times has learned that up to five generals and admirals are willing to resign rather than approve what they consider would be a reckless attack. There are four or five generals and admirals we know of who would resign if Bush ordered an attack on Iran, a source with close ties to the British intelligence said. There is simply no stomach for it in the Pentagon, and a lot of people question whether such an attack would be effective or even possible. Now, the British defense source confirmed that there were deep misgivings inside the Pentagon about a military strike, and they said, quote, all the generals are perfectly clear that they don't have the military capacity to take Iran on in any meaningful fashion. Nobody wants to do it, and it would be a matter of conscience for them. There are enough people who feel that this would be an error of judgment too far for there to be resignations. A general's revolt on such a scale would be unprecedented. The FSB further reported that there was complicity of the American president in the attempt to have the US military arrest his own vice president by citing American media reports detailing the official claims controlled by the United States military, and which say, quote, but the Bush administration has a plane problem. One of the President Bush's two 747 jets is going through a major maintenance overhaul, and two of the four 757 jets are also in maintenance. The President always needs a backup plane, so he's taken one of the 757s. That just leaves one 757 for high-level officials like Vice President Cheney and the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, to share, and both had scheduled overseas trips that week. Can't quite see what the relevance of that part is amongst the rest of the report, but it goes on to say that the American military establishment has also threatened their war leaders by releasing to the US propaganda media organs some of the most secret and damning evidence of past manipulation of their citizens through terror and intimidation, to include previously unreleased CIA video of the assassination of the American President John F. Kennedy, showing the alleged assassin Lee Harvey Oswald standing in a crowd of spectators seconds before he was supposed to have fired at the American President. And it says there's a note here, Lee Harvey Oswald, the former Russian KGB and American CIA agent, can be plainly seen wearing the green sweater he was later wearing when arrested. There we are. There's quite an odd one there. Now, the second report, which was evidently a suicide attempt on Vice President Dick Cheney, was one carried out by a Taliban suicide bomber on Tuesday, February the 27th, and it reads that as many as 14 people died, including a US soldier, and 27 were injured in the attack at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. Now, this report came through Chris Hughes, who's a journalist for the Daily Mail in the UK, of course, and it reads as follows. It is feared news of Cheney's overnight stay at the base, which was shrouded in secrecy, was leaked. Mr. Cheney was in his room after the snow forced a trip to the capital of Kabul to be cancelled. He said, at 10 a.m. I heard a boom. They moved me for a brief period to one of the bomb shelters. As the situation settled, I went back to my room until it was time to leave. Among the dead were a South Korean soldier and a US contractor whose nationality was unknown. Taliban spokesman Mullah Hayat Khan told reporters on the phone, "We wanted to target Cheney." The vice president left soon after to meet Afghan President Hamid Karzai in Kabul, 60 miles away. It says that the attack comes as al-Qaeda and the Taliban are said to be regrouping for spring offensive. And the UK Foreign Secretary, Margaret Beckett, also arrived in Kabul. That was on Tuesday the 27th. And she flew from Pakistan after talks with President Musharraf over suspected havens for militants. This came along in the same week as the UK Defence Secretary Des Brown said that 1,400 troops are being sent to Afghanistan to bolster the numbers of British troops already there. That's interesting, isn't it? You might guess, I suppose, if you're in this position that President Dick Cheney is in and you're sort of rattling your sabre, that some people will want to get back at you. Now, an odd news item here comes from somewhere that I haven't got a note of, but it must be a section out of a magazine, I guess, or a paper called Science Health. I'm sorry that I don't have all the full details, but this is unfortunately what happens when people circulate news via the email. They don't always give you the full detail. This relates to the FDA, who announced on the 2nd of March that 28 US babies reportedly developed a potentially deadly bowel problem after getting the Rotatec vaccine. The babies developed intussusception, a serious and potentially life-threatening condition in which the intestine gets blocked or twisted. Now that's all I have on that particular item. And it's yet another story about the dangers attached to having vaccinations. I suppose, to be fair, you have to take things in real terms and look at percentages. We know that most drugs probably result in the death of some people. So I suppose we mustn't get too taken away by those figures. I think it's the fact that you're talking about dangerous vaccines for babies. The next item I have here is one that's really surprising. I suppose it must have got into the press in the US, but it goes back a few weeks, and this is the first time I've seen anything at all relating to it. It comes from a source called The Onion, and in fact that is a website, theonion.com. And the report comes from Washington, D.C., saying that President Bush announced on Monday of the week, February the 14th, that his administration will permanently sever ties with the democratically controlled United States Congress, thereby ending a nearly 220-year-old alliance between the two governmental branches. George Bush is quoted as saying, "Our administration no longer recognizes the authority of this rogue body." He apparently said that in a televised Oval Office address. And he even said, "Clearly these combative men and women have a political agenda in direct opposition to our own. I have no concern for our national interests and have left me no choice." The report reads that after 6 years of cordial relations between the executive and legislative branches of government, tensions flared up in January when Congress came under the control of a hostile new leadership. And after a dramatic standoff last week, and bear in mind that then would have been the first week in February, over American policy in Iraq, the President openly denounced Congress, refused to accept calls from majority leaders, and returned to Congress, approved legislation unsigned and unread. In addition to his decision to cut off all communication, collaboration and trade of ideas with the House and Senate, Bush also issued an executive order effective immediately, removing all White House officials from the U.S. Capitol. Most prominent among those recalled was Vice President Dick Cheney, who also serves as the President of the Senate several days per year. The report reads on, Cabinet members who had been giving testimony before congressional committees were quickly ushered to the roof of the Senate wing of the Capitol, where they boarded Marine One, the presidential helicopter, and were flown back to the White House. The writer of the article said, "I will withhold judgment until Congress has voted on the matter." Interesting, isn't it? It's a bit like in the UK, if our government cut off their House of Lords, which also possibly has a similar power. They can have bills returned to the government if they reject them. I think the government also in the ultimate has the power to get bills through nevertheless. They have their place, I think, in keeping the balance in what happens. Next report I have is one that's, I think, got a lot of media attention, possibly not in the ones that are heavily censored and obviously support the Illuminati and the Dark Cabal. It's talking about the news report on the BBC television, where they reported that a building, that is WTC Building 7, of the 9/11 afternoon had fallen, had collapsed in fact, and announced it 20 minutes before it fell. And if you haven't heard of this, it showed the announcer obviously reading off the cue, announcing that the building had collapsed, where, much to everyone's astonishment, in the background you can still see WTC7 standing, obviously quite proudly, with nothing at all happening. This report came from Prison Planet, which is an excellent internet website, through Paul Joseph Watson and Alex Jones. That came out on Monday the 26th of February. And I'll tell you just a short write-up of what they had about it. And they were saying an astounding, video uncovered from the archives today shows the BBC reporting on the collapse of WTC Building 7 over 20 minutes before it fell at 5:20 p.m. on the afternoon of 9/11. The incredible footage shows BBC reporter Jane Stanley talking about the collapse, as she called it, of the Salomon Brothers building while it remained standing in the live shot behind it. And it says, minutes before the actual collapse of the building is due, the feed to the reporter mysteriously dies. You have to think, don't you, that someone actually noticed the situation that they placed themselves in, and they didn't want themselves to be embarrassed by actually seeing the building fall so long after she announced it had actually happened. Now, a couple of days after that, a further report came out by way of qualifying what they found out about this event. Don't actually know where this one came from, beyond the fact that I got it through the email system. But it talks as follows, that both the announcer in the clip and the lower third banner report the collapse of WTC7. The timestamp shows 21:54 or 9:54 p.m. British time, mentioning that in the British summer, time is 1 hour ahead of Greenwich Mean Time. Since the US is also on daylight savings time in September 9, or in September, 9:54 p.m. British time is 4:54 p.m. East Coast time. So they've worked out from that, of course, that that is roughly 20 minutes before WTC7 actually came down. And they're saying, what seems to be emerging here is that Flight 93 was planned to crash into WTC7. And when Flight 93 had to be shot down instead, because the crew regained control, WTC7 still had to come down, or the pre-placed explosives inside would have given the whole game away. And what seems likely is that a time was set for the demolition and sent out to agents in the media, but there was an unexpected delay to clear responders from the building, which is why WTC7 is seen still standing behind the female announcer even as she reports the building destroyed. So, 9/11 never goes away. There's always something coming up, isn't there? And the proof of the inside job just grows and grows. Now, in the UK, the BBC screened a programme which was looking into the death of Dr. David Kelly, who you'll no doubt recall was the head man, or one of the head men, of the group of inspectors that went to Iraq to look for weapons of mass destruction. They did a poll in the UK, that was one carried out by the BBC, and they found that nearly a quarter of all people did not believe former government weapons inspector Dr. David Kelly killed himself. 23% didn't believe the official verdict that he committed suicide, while 39% believed he did, and the rest, the other 39%, said they did not know. Now, Dr. Kelly was found dead on July the 18th, 2003, after being named as the possible source of the BBC story on the government's Iraq weapons dossier. And he was the one who said quite adamantly that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And he let certain information out which put him in a bad light, I suppose, because he should have kept that information secret. An official inquiry was carried out, which came to be called the Hutton Inquiry, after Lord Hutton, who chaired it. And the official account said that Dr. Kelly committed suicide by cutting his left wrist, and he had also taken an overdose of the painkiller coproxenol. The poll comes ahead, actually, of a three-part BBC Two series, which has started, and they have followed on by investigating the World Trade Center attacks, and also going to look at the Oklahoma City bombing. Now, I've got an additional item on Dr. David Kelly, and this was from the Sunday Mirror on February the 25th, and an MP who's taken up his death as his own cause to investigate him, a Liberal MP, Liberal Democrat, called Norman Baker, has said that despite an official inquiry concluding the death was suicide, he believes he was murdered. And he spent more than a year investigating the death, and he ruled out suicide, natural causes, or an accident. And he says it must have been some sort of murder. If it wasn't suicide, the only explanation was someone disposed of him. So, there is the UK's own, if you like, type of JFK assassination. And maybe we realise that even in the UK we can't trust what the government or the secret services get up to. And we're not to know, of course, at this stage whether the agents that carried out that murder came from abroad anyway. Now, something that's cropped up, in my opinion, a number of times over the last couple of years or so, and that is people who are prepared to challenge the income tax law. I've got one here that makes an interesting story about a Louisiana attorney, Tommy K. Cryer. He's apparently the Hall of Fame attorney, an honor graduate of LSU Law School, and a member of the prestigious Order of the Coif, and apparently he's got a reputation for taking on issues that no one else would, and he's made a number of new inroads in the legal world, but he's now thrown down the gauntlet in front of the mother of all 800-pound gorillas. So said the person who formulated this report. It's actually come from a site that gathers news items and messages and things called 4winds10.com. Again, I haven't got the actual source of the report where it originally came from, but never mind. The research carried out by Tommy K. Cryer was regarding the tax laws. But it not only included them, but he went past the first income tax in 1861 to the drafting of the Constitution, and included reading hundreds of cases, congressional archives and tax laws from 1913 to the present. and he learned through a friend that he had only a piece of the picture, and he was right. And he said, the tax code and its regulations are carefully, and he adds, ingeniously crafted to deceive. He explains that the answer is not in what the law says, but rather in what they do not say. And those provisions that are revealing are either hidden within tons of verbiage or behind double and triple negatives. And more importantly, he says he knows why. So Cryer decided he would also stop filling returns in and would challenge the IRS if and when it came to court. And Cryer said, once you've taken an oath to uphold the Constitution and the law, obeying the law is only half the job. You also have to be willing to fight for it. I've not only sworn to fight for the Constitution as an attorney, as a former officer in the army, I've sworn to die for it. Apparently in 2001 they came, demanding information returns, and Cryer advised them that if they could show him any law making him liable or making his revenues taxable, he would file any tax returns required by the law. And they could not show him any law. There you are, that's all I wanted to say. He's apparently not the first person to have taken up that challenge, and no doubt he won't be the last. Right, just bear with me while I have another sip of water. For some reason, I've got a little bit of a dry throat, so when you're talking for the length of time that I'm doing, you start to get a little hoarse. Michael Shank apparently writes an article on foreign policy in Focus. It was dated the 16th of February, and it appeared on truthout.org, which again is another excellent website. What he was talking about with Chomsky, Noam Chomsky, who's a noted linguist and author and foreign policy expert, was about the developments in US policy toward Iran, Iraq, North Korea, Venezuela. And Shank said, with similar nuclear developments in North Korea and Iran, why has the United States pursued direct diplomacy with North Korea but refuses to do so with Iran? Now, Chomsky said, to say that the United States has pursued diplomacy, oh dear me, get me tongue-tied now, diplomacy with North Korea is a little bit misleading. It did under the Clinton administration, though neither side completely lived up to their obligations. Clinton didn't do what was promised, nor did North Korea, but they were making progress. So when Bush came into the presidency, North Korea had enough uranium or plutonium for maybe one or two bombs, but then very limited missile capacity. During the Bush years, it's exploded. The reason is he immediately cancelled the diplomacy, and he's pretty much blocked it ever since. Now, this is the point of this article. They made a very substantial agreement in September 2005 in which North Korea agreed to eliminate its enrichment programs and nuclear development completely. In return, the United States agreed to terminate the threats of attack and begin moving towards the planning for the provision of a light water reactor, which had been promised under the framework agreement. But the Bush administration instantly undermined it. Right away, they cancelled the international consortium that was planning for the light water reactor, which was a way of saying, we're not going to agree to this agreement. A couple of days later, they started attacking the financial transactions of various banks. It was timed in such a way to make it clear that the United States was not going to move towards its commitment to improve relations. And, of course, it never withdrew the threats. So that was the end of the 2005 agreement. Pretty sad, isn't it, really? I mean, I'm anti-Bush because I don't believe in war, certainly not the wars that are going on now, and I believe in peace. But when you hear things like that, you can see that you have a man there who is determined to carry on extending his wars and creating chaos in the world. I find that very sad. Little article here, another sad one really, from the Clatchy newspaper, saying that the percentage of poor Americans who are living in severe poverty has reached a 32-year high, and millions of working Americans are falling closer to poverty line, and the gulf between the nation's haves and have-nots continues to widen. Mitachi newspaper analysis of 2005 census figures, which were the latest available, found that nearly 16 million Americans are living in deep or severe poverty. A family of four with two children and an annual income of less than $9,903, half the federal poverty line, was considered severely poor in 2005. So were individuals who made less than $5,080 a year. And the McClatchy analysis found that the number of severely poor Americans grew by 26% from 2000 to 2005. Amazing, isn't it? In a country, I think that the world views as being one that's very rich in many ways, to find such an awful figure relating to the poor people of America. Now to something a little bit more cheerful. There's a report that came on the website creativeyouth.net talking about Denis Kucinich, someone who I admire greatly. Apparently, he was giving a speech to a forum audience, and he received the biggest applauses from the Carson City, Nevada audience. And it was in the forum held by AFSCME and moderated by George Stephanopoulos. He said other candidates received limited applause, and most appeared to put the audience to sleep. But Kucinich woke up the sleeping audience. He did not just receive a few thunderous applauses, he received close to a dozen thunderous applauses during his presentation. The audience was riveted and eager to shout out in unison the answer to the reason for war, which of course was oil. And the audience also repeatedly shouted out the reason why Kucinich could get through a universal health care plan for the benefit of the people instead of for the profits of the insurance companies, and keep his other promises, no strings. Kucinich's presentation skills were similar to what one would expect from Tony Robbins, and even Sam Donaldson commenting on ABC about Kucinich's showmanship. And Kucinich's supporters have been saying that to see him is to love him. The audience reactions to this debate seems to have proven their point. Wonderful. I like the man very much, and as I've said before, I'm sure he is penciled in to be either the new president or vice president elect. Final item I have is a very nice one, or a nice story. Came out on Thursday, the 1st of March. The story was on rumormillnews.com, another good site. And basically, it was talking about youngsters who they refer to as indigo and crystal youngsters, who have hugely embarrassed the French government in big protest and action over homeless. And apparently a grassroots uprising started as from 16th of December 2006. And it was being driven by the expanded consciousness of young people in France who have created a community action phenomenon which has greatly embarrassed the French government. Apparently, over recent years, the French have faced a big problem, the growing numbers of homeless on the streets of its cities. Now, a single inspired individual, whose name they didn't know in the major report, made an approach to Médecine Sans Frontières, a very proactive French-based international aid group, and between them, they hatched a very high-profile plan. Médecine Sans Frontières made available large numbers of bright red tents, and these were pitched side by side along the canals, and shortly after, along both banks of the River Seine, in the very centre of Paris. And homeless people from miles away started to come, and on arrival, each were given blankets and a package of basic necessities. And apparently, on the opening day of the project, ordinary householders were invited to spend a winter night in one of these tents and fully connect with the experience. And the number accepted and did so, and they lived with the homeless for long enough to fully reconnect their compassion for the situation and went on to support the action. And as I was saying, of course, in the centre of the tourist areas of Paris, these bright red tents gave the public, or gave the most public exposure rather, imaginable to the problem. And it's easy to imagine the embarrassment of the government. Apparently many other similar encampments are starting to spring up on other riverbanks, passing through the centres of many of the larger French cities. And it says young people, many of whom were only in their teens or even younger, had taken the initiative. Apparently they call themselves the Children of Don Quixote. Now that's a nice story to finish on, I think. I'm going to come now to a couple of short UFO items, and then I will have time to read fully an excellent message from Archangel Michael. Again, I'm going back to the same Flying Saucer review that I took an extract from last week, which is the November-December issue from 1969. Talking here of someone called Monsieur Jean Senac, who lived in the Pyrenees in France. He was age 71. Apparently one day, late morning, in broad daylight, he was the witness of what is described as sensational and mysterious happenings on the departmental highway. It happened, as it was then, 4 years prior, so that makes it 1965. And it said, apart from the inhabitants of the neighbouring villages, the public has never heard of it until now. And the statement made by Monsieur Senac is as follows. I'm no longer quite sure of the precise date, but I know it was after the straw had been cut. It was in the first half of July 1964. And he's talking of being beyond a spot on the road where it crosses another one. And it is dumbfounded to see an extremely bright, shining machine lying athwart the road and the verge of the road. He said the sun was shining, the visibility was excellent, and I was amazed to see this strange shining craft, which looked like nothing known to me. He might have said it looked like a table, but I could not make out its precise shape, because it was so dazzlingly bright. It was approximately 700 feet from where he stood. And he said if a car or any other familiar object was around, you couldn't have been mistaken, even if you couldn't see all the precise details. From its position on the road, I should say it was about, 10 feet long. Its height was about that of a passenger car, perhaps a little bit less. He said it seemed to me that it was not quite touching the ground, but there weren't any wheels, and I can't say whether or not there were any legs. At that point, it suddenly rose up and flew off towards Pew Dario at great speed. And he said such a thing was totally unexpected. And my astonishment knew no bounds. I was still standing there looking at the place when I caught sight of two strange forms. They were little known absolute dwarfs, which might have been hidden from my sight by the machine. As you can see, I myself am not very tall, but they were a lot smaller than me. Monsieur Senac indicated their height, which was a little over 3 foot. He said they were wearing a sort of clothing that I could not see very well, but the colour of it was khaki. And of that, I am dead certain. I can tell it at a great distance, and in broad daylight, as far off as this, I can't be mistaken. Then I watched those two little beings walk along beside the hedge about 30 metres or so in my direction. They went through a gap in the hedge and walked through the bracken towards that tree over there. And they seemed to be bent forwards with loads on their backs, and I could see a sort of sack on the back of each, but could not make out the details. He said, without losing a minute, he went back to the place where he was, and he set off towards a certain tree where he saw these two beings, and he found traces where they had been, and there were marks of trampling underneath the tree. That's all I wanted to read there. I have to say that report sounds familiar. I've got a sneaking feeling I've probably read that one before. Never mind. Anybody who hasn't heard it, then for them will be for the first time. There's a short report here about the UFO that was spotted one evening in October 67 in Portland, Dorset, which is in the UK. This is about a separating UFO. And apparently two people were travelling in separate cars, and it was dusk, and they were passing through a village when one driver noticed an object hovering over a garage. The car's engine stalled, and for a time he was cruising in top gear, and then he pointed it out to his brother-in-law, who was in the other car. He estimated the object to be about 200 feet up. It was cigar-shaped and about 70 feet long, and one of the witnesses described it as being coffee brown with yellow lines of regular shape along its length, giving the impression of observation windows. By this time, several other cars had stopped, and the object was observed for about 5 minutes, and then Mr. Drews and his brother-in-law became rather scared, so they re-entered their car and drove on. And by then, the object had risen into the sky and kept pace with them, crossing the road en route. When they reached a certain point further along the road, they stopped the car again. The object stopped also, hovering over houses opposite the cafe. And one was a police house, it happened. Mr. Drews ran over to it, and when he returned with the police officer, the object had vanished. So he assured the officer that it had been there when it reappeared, this time in a totally different form. It was a blaze of coloured light, and Mr. Drews clearly saw red, green, yellow, blue, etc. in bands of colour. By this time, the sky was completely dark. They watched the object for some minutes, and a strange thing happened. The glowing object split into two sections. One section went under the other and rejoined. Thus, the object took on a totally different shape. After this manoeuvre, the object vanished for a moment, then reappeared, and about 2 minutes later, it began to move away, slowly at first, then disappeared very swiftly, as if travelling at a phenomenal speed. Well, interesting one, that. Right, I'm now able to come to something I've been wanting to read out, which will conclude the meeting, that's absolutely certain, because I won't have my time to read anymore. It's a wonderful message from Archangel Michael. It's his February message through Rona Herman. And it's called Processing Your Macro Mind and Your Macrocosm Awareness. Now, I don't think I actually started that message, although I suppose it's familiar to me because I've had it in front of me at the time. It reads as follows. Beloved Masters, you are ready to expand your vision beyond your private little world and microcosmic reality. Are you ready to accept and willing to accept the truth that you affect everyone and everything in this universe to one degree or another, and that everyone on Earth and in every other realm also affects you? You are a microcosm or a miniature universe within the microcosm which contains the totality of the omniversal experience. You have been described as a cell within the heart-mind of the Supreme Creator, and this is a valid description. As the Supreme Creator radiates more and more of the elixir of life throughout the omniverse, it is affecting all creation. You cannot hide from it, you cannot deny it. Your lifeline to your source is growing stronger and more persuasive all the time. The magnetization factor is growing stronger, and you are magnetizing to you in stronger and stronger measures that which you have claimed as your reality. If you believe that you must live in poverty and chaos, then you will be reinforced and that magnified in your life. If you have accepted the truth that you are entitled to a life of beauty, joy and prosperity, that reality will unfold before you. It is as if your lifeline is being tugged and pulled in different directions as spirit tries to get your attention. There will be no denying the evolutionary cycle that is now in full swing. The soul self is nudging and prodding everyone, to one degree or another, in an effort to get the soul's attention. No one can maintain the status quo, coasting and drifting, and ignoring the call to awaken. You must either grow and ascend in consciousness or sink deeper into chaos and limitation, postponing the inevitable. We have often stated you are destined to return to a perfect state, so why not enjoy the journey? As you expand your consciousness and begin to use your sacred mind or macro mind, your reality will change very quickly. That is what we have been explaining to you over these past 2 years as we endeavour to assist you in perfecting the Alpha Mastery techniques. The micro mind is your beta consciousness, whereas your Alpha Master mind is your macro mind consciousness, which helps your subconscious mind to become conscious as the old subjective negative programming from the past is released and transmuted, and the conscious mind becomes receptive to the downloading of cosmic information from the higher realms of knowledge. Archangel Michael goes on to talk about a particular exercise to expand the consciousness and stay centered in the heart. I won't go through that one because that will be for anyone who cares to read it fully, and they can, of course, go to ronastar.com to find that. But I will read on and say most of you who are reading these messages are ready for the next step. And many of you have already completed the process of opening the portal way at the back of the heart. This is the portal that gives you access to the celestial cities of light. And if you have been visiting the city of light in the higher dimensions in your area via your pyramid of light in the fifth dimension, your portal way at the back of the heart is already opening and functioning. When you first incarnated on planet Earth and gradually assumed the physical vessel, your column of light was as wide as your crown, that is the halo over your head. And all the way back to our Mother, Father, God, and the Supreme Creator, and this vibrant, life-giving energy radiated from the front and back of your heart chakra out into the world around you. Over the time, the sinking into the density of the third, fourth dimensional environment and experiencing so much heartache, most of you gradually built an etheric shield of protection over the heart, thereby diminishing the flow of love and light to and from you. Right, I see actually that is a recap of what I did start last week. I hadn't actually thought I'd started it. But anyway, that keeps you on track. So to continue, to speed up the process of fully activating and opening this portal, we will now make a small change in the infinity breath technique. Well, I won't go into that fully because, again, that is following on the earlier exercises that were mentioned. And what he goes on to say is our Father, Mother, God, the Elohim and the Archangels have created living pyramids of light within every level of creation so that you can access the building blocks of life. These life-giving forms give you access to the frequencies of light, which are necessary components of transformation so that you, as human beings, can return to an exalted state of consciousness, your divine state. The same applies to higher frequency energies from the cities of light. Once you make the connection, it begins this trickle-down process whereby a constant stream of just the right magnitude and frequency patterns flows into your pyramid of light and down your column of light to you. And he's talking of envisioning an etheric replica of yourself lying on your crystal table. Now, this is one which is concerned with the pyramid meditation. That's a very nice one. I do it occasionally. And he's saying that inside this pyramid, if you see a replica of yourself lying on the crystal table, it will remain there when you are focused on your physical body, and you will merge with it when you visit your pyramid and lie on the crystal table. And each time you merge with it, that is that facet of yourself in the fifth dimension, you will absorb more of the refined frequencies of light that have been integrated into your etheric replica during your absence. So that's it, basically. I haven't read out the full message because it talks in great detail of what you need to do to follow those exercises in the Pyramid of Light meditation. There I have to leave you, my friends. I'll quickly tell you that next week I shall start the program with my first interview with Robert Schwartz, the author of Courageous Souls. I hope you'll be with me. Thank you for being with me for this program. God bless you all.